once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And let's see, first thing we do is a disclosure and disclaimer. So let's see, the disclosure is that The Personal Wealth Coach is not merely a riveting, which can be very painful.
Yeah, don't get riveted. That's painful.
Yeah, riveting things. Radio presentation that happens on Saturday mornings, in this particular case on Saturday, February 4th, 2017. It is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that does wealth management for people who have significant amounts of money invested. That's located in Salado, Texas, and registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission as our regulator of choice. Okay, that was the disclosure. Disclaimer, nothing we say on this radio program is or should be considered legal, tax, or investment advice. This is educational only, and you need to speak to your legal, tax, or investment advisor for specific investment advice. Let's see. Yes. If you have an investment advisor, which is very, very different, of course, from a financial advisor who is a salesperson. So I have now disclosed and disclaimed. Anything else we need to do? Dispose.
Dispose? Yeah. So yes. We can just dispose of ourselves here. That will be good.
And then
can I explain that disclaimer a little bit?
Sure.
The idea of what we're doing literally is for education. If a caller calls in and we tell that caller one thing, it won't be the right thing for most of the other listeners. So, unfortunately,
we should tell them two things.
Right. We should tell them all the things. And yes, that's the problem with specific advice on the air. Without knowing who you are, good advice is really hard to give.
I can give some advice.
Oh, go ahead.
Please. Buy low, sell high.
Uh-huh.
But don't buy lows necessarily.
Right.
Buy low, sell high, and don't get involved in a land war on the Asian continent.
Okay.
Right.
Right. With your portfolio or without, for that matter.
That's good advice, you know. Wear your seatbelts. Oh, yeah. You used to have a really good one that you always gave. Close cover before striking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That was a good one.
Yeah.
I didn't come up with that myself. Somebody else coined that phrase.
Oh,
yeah. But I use it occasionally. Okay. Yeah.
There was another one you had, but I don't remember what it was. It was equally ubiquitous.
Authorized personnel only.
Right, right. Only.
Maybe it's unauthorized personnel.
I actually printed a bunch of signs at one point just before I left college. They would have fired me otherwise. It said unauthorized personnel only to put on the doors. And it confused a lot of professors. Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach. We do have a telephone number, and it is 254-773-1400.
That's it. That's the number.
I'm trying to catch him a little off here and throw Jake just a little bit off center on this. Okay, so what happened in the market this week?
Oh, we were going to say the market. What happened in the market this week? Well, the beginning of the week, we had semi-panic running in circles. The end of the week, we had, well, maybe it's not so bad running in circles.
Oh, well, yeah, well, more specifically, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 229.65 points on Monday and Tuesday. And then it turned around and got them all back. And for the Dow, at least, it got almost back as high as it was at the beginning of the week, down down a little bit. For the week, it was down 0.1%. The S&P 500 was up 0.2%. So the Dow was down this week and the S&P 500 up. Not much. And, both of them are still up a bit for the year, which is good if you're an investor. So why did they do that this week?
Big news. That's why they did it this week.
Yeah.
Mostly politics. Mm-hmm. And that's something that has an impact on the market. It doesn't have a big impact short term on the economy, but the market reacts, and boy does it. This week, the beginning of the week was really about what type of regulatory reform does it mean in those executive orders, and whoa, there's some really big executive orders that just went out that are likely to fail, and we don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Basically, when the market reacts like that, it's because they're saying, we don't know mm-hmm. a lot.
Yeah, basically, the immigration order had the potential, before it was overturned by a federal judge, and still does to some degree, had the potential to reduce earnings. The airline stocks dropped pretty substantially. A number of companies dropped.
A lot of the tech stocks, yeah.
Because they are dependent on people who were at that point locked out of the country, or at least partially dependent upon them. And the airlines were in a bit of turmoil at that point. So they dropped. And then when two things happened in rather rapid succession at the end of the week, one is that President Trump reiterated and issued some executive orders that are intended to reduce the regulatory burden, and reiterated that he is for reducing taxes on corporations.
So corporate folks go, oh, that's good news. And investors said, whoa, that's good news. And that had the most impact on the tech. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first part of the week had the most impact on a negative way on tech stocks. The second half of the week had the most impact in a positive way on bank stocks or mm-hmm. financials.
Right. And you're going to see some more seesawing. And one of the things to really, I think, and we mentioned this in the newsletter, and I think it's very important to get your mind around this. Yeah, the market's up well over 10% since the election. But, and here's the big but here.
Are you talking about mine?
No, I'm not. I'm not. You do not have a big butt.
Oh, okay.
It's all on rhetoric. It's all on promises to cut taxes and on corporations and reduce regulations, which would cause the corporations to have higher earnings in the future. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about that a little later, at least I hope to. The Ed Yardini has got a pretty careful analysis of what that means to the market. The market may be up about 10%, but he says it's got another 10% to go if indeed everything passes the way it has been presented to pass. But there's the clinch. That's the big if,
and that's basically what we've been talking about mm-hmm. since November. Once it's beyond rhetoric and actually into policy and law, we can begin to make some judgments on what impact it's going to have. And we can look and see how likely something is to happen.
See, right now, for the rest of the year, nobody can accurately even make a educated guess as to what corporate earnings will be a year from now, because we don't know what the tax laws are going to be a year from now.
We don't know tax laws. We don't know the regulatory environment.
Right.
We don't know what rules that exist already are going to be enforced and which ones are not. We don't know the immigration environment, which is needed if you're in a, you know, this isn't a open sourced concept. The Labor Department agrees with it. So do many other areas. There are about 100,000 unfilled, highly skilled, highly educated jobs in the tech world. That's unfilled. They are looking for people to do that. If we can't fill the openings in 100,000 jobs because the people aren't trained to do it, if you start limiting other people who hold jobs like that, we don't have Americans trained to do it that aren't already working for someone and getting paid very well. It means our expansion slows down. What does that do to earnings? It's not good. Now, then there's the corporate tax rate side. Well, that's great for earnings, but we don't know what's actually going to come out yet. And then there's the, there's enough moving pieces in here, the regulatory environment.
Basically, you're two big elements pushing here, I think. One is on one side, you've got the cut corporate taxes, reduce regulations.
Right.
That's positive for corporations, positive for the market.
May not be positive long term for U.S. debt, but short term, it's very positive.
Yes. Yeah, so we've got a positive for earnings over the next several years and corporations and thereby valuations on stocks. On the other side is the really unformed potential to start trade wars. One of the main reasons that the stock market, if you look at the timing of the actual stock market drop earlier in the early part of the week, the announcement that President Trump had hung up on the Prime Minister of Australia, one of our major trading partners and one of our most staunch allies in the world, that has sent soldiers to every war we have gone into, whether it was popular or not, you see a dramatic drop in the stock market at that point. And the reason is, very frankly, the president is insulting people upon whom corporations depend for exports and imported raw materials.
Right.
And when you do that, the potential is, for example, Australia has the ability to pivot to do more trade with China and less trade with the United States, which, by the way, the Chinese have been begging them to do for a long time.
Right.
And a lot of analysts look at that very carefully and say, whoa, if you get the Australians insulted enough and angry enough, and by the way, hanging up on one's prime minister,
well, the
is
Australians,
not a good thing to do.
The Australians say that didn't happen. Trump mentions tough phone calls, and lots of people in the administration have said that didn't happen. So when the Australians and the Americans are both saying it didn't happen, but there's an unknown source that said it did.
Well, the Australian prime minister didn't comment on it. He didn't deny it. He didn't acknowledge it.
The prime minister didn't.
Right.
Trump didn't either. But
he said it was the worst telephone call he'd had. It lasted 35 minutes when it was scheduled for an hour.
Right.
And apparently somebody who was in on the call on the Trump side said he hung up on him.
Yeah. There have been enough people denying that on both sides. The reality is that it may not have been a hang up, but nobody's denying the fact that it was not a pleasant conversation.
Well, Trump,
and this is the first conversation with one of our major allies to choose points of contention as your opening statement. That's not good for trade. Mm. It's not good for business relationships unless you're just trying to dominate everyone. And the reality is that unless you have a global monopoly on all corporate activity, you don't dominate everyone.
Mm-hmm. And it's we'll see how this works out. But I'm not saying, and it could be that President Trump's position was an opening gambit in a negotiation. We don't know. That's not the purpose of us. Our purpose is not to assess whether it was good, bad, or indifferent. The purpose is to let you know, if there are any listeners, that the potential exists to lose that 10% bump that we currently have in the market very suddenly.
And so the opposite is that the potential exists that
mm-hmm.
it could go
right.
the upward direction very suddenly. And the reality is that volatility, it's not quite a law of physics. It's not like gravity or momentum or mass. But there's a really good rule in the market. Uncertainty breeds volatility. And we've got a lot of uncertainty
mm-hmm.
right now. And there's a lot of good news that's popping out
yep.
and a lot of bad news that's popping out. And the market's not really sure what to do with it yet.
The market, the stock market, compared to where it was at the end, at least the Dow, not the Dow. Well, yeah, the Dow too. But the S&P 500 is up about 22%. From where it was at this time last year. Now, last year the world was coming to an end because the oil markets were all going to collapse and our houses were going to burn down and there wouldn't be enough oil. No, wait a minute. Oil was cheap. Anyway.
Yeah. Oil was cheap this time. This is why the market
yeah.
collapsed, not because it was expensive. That was the other collapse.
But it's an example to say, okay, the price of oil falling is a disaster? Nah.
No.
But the market still plunged 20% because of it. And so
– but on the other end, at another time, the price of oil going up is a disaster.
Right.
No. And the market collapsed because of it.
So particularly when we have this level of uncertainty and the market is currently up not because of underlying fundamentals of wonderful earnings and the tax code got fixed and all of this goes, it's up on the hope that all this will happen. We could lose it. Or, now, the backside to this, if you will, and I happen to agree with Yardini's speculation on this, he's saying 2,500 on the S&P 500 this year, but he also says it's entirely possible we could get more than that. We could see, and hang on to your hats here, folks, Well, maybe you don't have hats. I'm the one who has a hat. Anyway, hang on to something. It's entirely possible to see the policy changes as they're filtered through Congress if they are – if the trade war issue is muted and the regulatory and tax issues are done by the way the Republicans in Congress want to do it right now, we could get a 20% jump in market valuation without changing – now listen to this – without changing the price-to-earnings ratio. In other words, we could see corporate earnings over the next 2 years rise 20% if we get a balanced approach that emphasizes taking the burdensome regulations off of the companies. Now, whether that's good or bad, again, that's not our judgment. Dodd-Frank is a very burdensome rule. It's very difficult and expensive for companies to follow it. The Labor Department has certainly issued a lot of very interesting rules that are very difficult to follow.
Right.
And as a result, if we roll all of those back, many of those rules were put in place to prevent another 2008-2009 event from happening. But if we roll all those rules back, there's no question that in concert with some tax law changes could dramatically raise the earnings of U.S. corporations. Now, whether in the long term that was the best thing is for somebody else to argue.
Because using the old regulations led to some not quite fraudulent, but not quite not fraudulent activity in a lot of sectors that the American people said, we need to change that. Mm-hmm. There was a big outcry against it. There was a big outcry for it. The outcry against it was bigger, so laws were passed that caused regulations to go into effect. They were a bit more than a bit. They were a huge group of regulations that was probably way beyond what we needed, but we needed something.
Yes, one of the drawbacks to the way we did this is kind of like the way Obamacare was done.
Yeah.
The stock market plunged in 1929 and hit bottom in – well, not a bottom. Didn't hit bottom until 1934, but it pretty much – most of its plunge was over within a year to 18 months. But it was 4 years later and 5 years later before Congress put together the law called the the Securities Act of 1933 and the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. And they didn't get around to the other two major acts that resulted from the Depression until 1940. In other words, they took some time. They got both the Republicans and the Democrats, at least enough Republicans to help, to agree that this was the right way to do it. And they passed some laws that are still on the books. They're still on the books. They're still in effect. Yes, they've been amended about 10 gazillion times. But
there was another act right in there. Okay. So we got Securities Act of 33, the Banking Act of 33,
right,
which was the first Glass-Steagall Act,
right,
which, by the way, is one of the things that was revoked in the mid-2000s. That was one of the causes and one of the solutions to the Great Recession.
Wasn't it under Reagan? It was revoked? No,
It was under Bush.
Okay.
George W. Bush. And it was well thought out, but not, and it left some big openings,
right,
where there were areas where people didn't know who was in charge, who was the regulator. And let me explain that. Glass-Steagall, that particular version that was pulled back, said that an investment bank and a commercial bank couldn't own each other. And what's an investment bank? What's a commercial bank? A commercial bank is the one you go to when you're depositing your paycheck, although you don't usually go to that anymore. It just gets there automatically. Somehow
the one that issues your credit card.
Right. The credit cards, the mortgage loans, the deposits and CDs are usually coming from a commercial bank. An investment bank, those are the people that underwrite big bond offerings from Ford or from the school district or from any other major, and then the big stock offerings, the IPOs, are underwritten by investment banks. Glass-Steagall said back in the Great Depression, hey, investment banks, you took a bunch of deposited money in a commercial side and invested it in a risky way, so stop doing that. You're not allowed to do it anymore.
And an important thing about investment banks, they take money they have and invest it, and they do so with little historically, before Dodd-Frank, they did so with very little regulatory oversight. In other words, if they want to invest in the London Whale Futures.
Right. They're allowed to do that.
They can do that, and they can take almost all of their money, which is in if it was your deposits in the bank, was your money, and deposit it in London Whale Futures.
Yeah. So
which basically Lehman Brothers did.
Let's go pre Dodd-Frank, because Dodd-Frank, it was way overboard. There were things that needed to be fixed, and there was a hole in the boat. And it caused a slow leak that got faster over time. Glass-Steagall came in after all of the water was pulled out of the boat, and it's floating a little bit again, but the leak's still there. Dodd-Frank came in, and it's a rowboat, and they used huge amounts of concrete and steel to fix the hole, which caused the boat not to function very well. Well, the hole was formed by taking a patch off that was put on by Glass-Steagall. And I think that would be a big step forward, just to take the piece of Glass-Steagall that was revoked and put it back in place, remove a lot of Dodd-Frank, but there were still a lot of Dodd-Frank that we needed.
Yeah, and
it was there. I mean, Republicans voted for this too, a lot of them.
Yeah.
Because there were some real problems that had to be fixed.
You know, replace and repeal is probably a good idea, but actually at this point, when we're looking at Dodd-Frank, what we're getting is repeal. Frankly,
and it's not even repeal. It's just a letter saying don't do these rules that were put in place because of it.
But in Congress right now, there are bills already out that have been posted, and they basically are repealing sections of Dodd-Frank. That's something that, it's going to be a reaction. It's going to be popular. It may pass. But very frankly, one of the things that we would want to watch for is if they just repeal and repeal and repeal, and they don't bring back in some structure.
This is the statement: the baby's out with the bathwater. We got to keep the baby.
If they don't bring back in some structure and keep the baby, or better yet, replace the baby with a better one. That's the analogy is getting a little bit weak,
right?
Here.
Well,
a little strange.
Let's use the baby as the idea for why the law exists.
Right.
Okay, so, the regulation on banks to prevent them from overdoing things, over foreclosing or over loaning to people when they say, well, the risk isn't ours because we're going to loan to somebody who can't pay it back, but we're going to sell this loan to someone else that doesn't know that. That's wrong.
And forcing – one of the things that the bill did in the – recently, the courts just overturned a piece of it, and apparently Congress is going to overturn the rest of it now, is it forced non-bank entities that acted like banks, like large insurance companies, to have the same kind of capital reserves that banks do. You know, and when you say large banks, large companies that act like banks.
AIG
right.
is a big example
right.
of that. They were the first company to show signs of peril going into the Great Recession, going into the collapse before it, mm-hmm. because they were acting like a bank.
Basically, when a bank loans money, if it loans out $1,000, it has to keep on in reserve a percentage of that the Federal Reserve sets against a certain percentage of its loans failing. And when a bank invests money, it has to do the same thing. Now, when you as a private investor invest money, nobody tells you you have to keep a certain cash reserve. For every dollar you invest, for every $100 you invest, you have to keep $12 in reserve.
Nobody says you have to do that.
And they don't say that to insurance companies, at least they didn't before Dodd-Frank.
And they didn't say it to investment banks before Dodd-Frank.
Right. And
they said it to commercial banks.
Right. So what happens is if you have a significantly large, and it's not the term they use, but a financially significant company in the United States, and a number of the larger life insurance companies fall into that category.
TBTF, too big to fail.
Right. So that if they failed, they could literally pull down the rest of the system unless the federal government intervened, which they are loath to do, and the way they intervened before is now against the law. So they put Dodd-Frank in there and said, okay, if you've been determined by the Federal Reserve to be financially significant in the economy, you must retain a certain reserve, and you have certain reporting requirements to the Federal Reserve as to what you're doing with your money. Prudential was the first one to get that overturned in court, says that the law that Dodd-Frank exceeded the authority of federal law, that the laws passed by the federal government says states regulate insurance companies and the federal government doesn't.
That is correct.
So if we slip back into that position, remembering that insurance companies, the big insurance companies, were the ones who were the trigger for this last time around, then we're in a position where down the road somewhere, insurance companies can once again speculate into very, very high yielding bonds with their portfolio. And if they can get the companies that put them together, which are the investment banks, and the rating companies to work together to make them look like really, really high quality bonds when in fact they are junk, we could get to do 2008, 2009 again. And that is in the process of being repealed. And it was probably put together too quickly.
It has a lot of extra junk in it. And man, does it have some extra junk in it. It's got so if you're hearing us say that it was a good law, you're hearing wrong. There were a lot of stuff in it. The majority of that law, I would even say, was inappropriate and overly regulatory.
But
there were parts of it that we need to be very careful about getting rid of.
One of the main reasons, and this is one of the – if I were to say there was a flaw out there that seems to be pretty universal right now, one of the main reasons that the law is so incredibly complex and burdensome is Congress decided not to federally regulate insurance companies because the states and the insurance company lobby – were really big and spent a lot of money making sure they didn't get regulated at the federal level like banks do.
There's another piece to this.
Well, let me finish this out, okay? And because they didn't want to do this politically unpopular thing, they tried to work all the way around it with a bunch of complexity.
Yeah, this is important. It isn't that they didn't want to. They didn't think they could. The insurance law is regulated by the state. The Congress can't just pass a law that says we're going to regulate insurance companies unless they're doing interstate trade.
Right. Any insurance company doing interstate
trade.
Right.
Right now, insurance companies have headquarters in each state in which they do business, and it's a separation from going across state lines. It's part of the problem with Obamacare. It's part of the problem with the insurance companies. The regulatory environment in each state is pulling back each part of it. Now, in the securities industry, the blue sky laws, each state passed a law that was pretty close to identical to every other state's laws that allowed regulations to be uniform.
You may be correct. But and I having my information is a couple of years old, but what happened was that used to be the case. But since deregulation became a big deal, insurance companies, generally speaking, today operate nationwide except for the state of New York. They have a separate entity in the state of New York operating under New York insurance laws, and then matter of fact, AIG has several subsidiaries that operate exclusively in New York, and they do operate across state lines so that if you're licensed with an insurance company, you are doing business across state lines very nicely. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I believe that's correct. But the issue is that the banks used to be that way. Banks used to be regulated by the states prior to 1934. And the federal government did pass a major law that says the banks were engaged in interstate commerce. And by the way, the insurance companies, if they accept checks from out of state, are engaged in interstate commerce. So you have something you're trying to show me.
Yeah, it's not going to go around. Basically, what I'm saying is that law hasn't changed regulation is by the state for insurance.
Right, and I agree with that. But I'm saying, and I'm thinking when, the federal government can do that.
When Dodd-Frank was passed, they believed that if they added regulation that would allow them to directly regulate the insurance companies in each state, that it would not pass a Supreme Court constitutionality test, that they would be in violation of their Commerce Clause. So that was a big factor. There are insurance companies that own the subsidiary companies in many states, but each of those subsidiaries have to follow and be registered with the state at great levels. Texas is one of those strongest insurance law states, as is New York. So there are states, and this is probably what you're talking about, that have laws that match each other's regulations, but it's not uniform across the country. So if Dodd-Frank were to have done that, they would have been held up in court and the whole thing may have been kicked out. That's part of the complication, that they overly complicated the regulations because they were talking about some very specific items.
We probably need to get to commercials.
Yes, I believe so as well. So if you would like to call in and join us for more of the Personal Wealth Coach, anything having to do with economics, not sports, we are not at all authorities on sports. You can call us at 254-773-1400. And we'll put you on the air. So until the end of the break, we'll be back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
Finally, now Texans have a less expensive...
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and...
Jake.
McClure. Telephone number's in here. The telephone number in here. Actually, it's a series of single-digit numbers, but it's still considered one number, is 254-773-1400, and you can call that from anywhere that you want to call from. And you can actually call internationally if you want to. Just put a 01 plus all those other numbers, 254-773-1400, and you can call us, and you can comment, question, deride, dispose. What else can they do?
Stay civil. They could be nice.
They could dispute.
Yes, I'm trying to be find some nice things they could do instead of just argue with us.
We have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Got kind of a hypothetical question, but 2 weeks into Trump's administration, he's proposing repatriation of money, cutting back on corporate taxes, mm-hmm. and a couple of other things. If you guys were advisors to Trump, assuming he would listen, what kind of advice, detailed advice, would you give him on some of his major
I would simply say listen to Paul Ryan.
Yeah,
okay,
that would be just really very simple because he spent a long time. He used to be the chairman of the House Banking Committee, as I recall. Was it the Banking or the Finance Committee? Anyway, Ways and Means. He really has studied this, and he's smart, and he spent a lot of time working up this A Better Way tax plan.
Yeah.
And if I were advising President Trump, and B, he would listen to me, which are two equally unlikely events, I would simply say, let Paul Ryan, let the Constitution work. All that stuff on finance and taxes and stuff is supposed to come out of the House.
Right. Yeah.
And he's got the same priorities you do. So what do you think, Jim?
Unfortunately, my advice to him would be almost universally impossible for him to follow. So
it's like your advice to me.
Yeah, I would tell him, stop tweeting without talking to the people who know this stuff. Only tweet stuff you know. Every time you say something that comes across as amateurish or uninformed, it deletes some of your political capital. The good ideas that you have get thrown in the same bin as the bad ideas. And he's not used to being a political animal. when he's used to being a populist animal. He's used to ratings and saying inflammatory things give you ratings, but they don't give you political support. They do give you, if you're coming in as the rebel and you're trying to get elected, you can bring in all the other people that want to say those same inflammatory things. But if you want to get the system changed short of outright revolution, you have to use the system to change it. And that means that you can't, in a CEO situation, you write a memo, and if it's wrong, you can change the memo. Because you're the CEO, you own the place. In the presidency, if you write an executive order, changing it on the fly is messy. It's really, really messy. He complained about executive orders, and yet it's the thing that he is using as his biggest tool at the moment. So basically, the reality is I would ask him to be more consistent and more thoughtful in his approach, but I don't think that's who he is, or he wouldn't be where he is.
You know, and again, from the financial point of view, by the way, if you want to feel good, just you can Google A Better Way, and the speaker's office has posted it online, and you can read the whole thing. And literally, and I know this sounds absurd, we've heard of this before, it has an example of a tax return done on a postcard. Now you have to do the calculation, and you have to do the calculations in the background, obviously, to get to the postcard. But there's only, the simplicity of the tax for individuals would be astonishingly increased for all of us under that tax plan. Now, whether the lobbyists will ever allow it to fly, I don't know. But it is really a very simple way of approaching getting adequate income taxes. And by the way, under A Better Way, they do drop the corporate rates down to 20%. And actually, Representative Ryan, Speaker Ryan, wanted to drop it to 15. But in return, and this is the problem, in return, some of our cherished deductions that distort the heck out of the economy sort of disappear, and it changes the capital gains rates to a percentage of your regular income tax rate. In other words, right. Basically figure your capital gains.
Here's one of the pieces that is difficult.
Let me finish it.
Okay.
You do your capital gains taxes as though it's income, but then you reduce it, as I recall, by 50%. You take half. Yeah, that's it. You take, for instance, if you say your capital gains, you had a gain of $100,000, and you turn out to be in the 20. You need to pay 20% of that to the government. That would be $20,000. You cut half of it off. You pay $10,000. And by the way, that's a lot more sensible, in my opinion, than the current way of doing business.
Right. One of the other factors that is getting in the way here, but that when you look at Congress. Congress is a nasty place. It's just not a good place. There's no cohesive thought pattern across Congress because it's a bunch of people that really don't agree with each other. Even people in the same parties really don't agree with each other. And they'll come together on certain things so that they can get the thing that is their pet, their baby. They want to get their thing done, so they're going to help you with your baby. And that kind of dealing doesn't fit in a one tweet situation. It doesn't fit into a 20 tweet situation. It's how many compromises have to be made to get a tax law done? And if Trump puts the pressure on too hard to get exactly what he wants and nothing else, he's not going to get anything. So if he says, you guys put it together and I'm going to veto it if it's not in general what I want, that's one thing. That's kind of the use of the president. But when he says, I don't support that because of these things, what he's really doing is setting himself up so that he can blame Congress rather than himself for tax code not being done. But the only way tax code gets done is through Congress. So it's he needs to have a little bit more of a hands-off approach and stop insulting the people on his side. If he wants them to work with him again later, there are a lot of really big egos in Congress and in particularly in the Senate. And the more you insult those people with the big egos, the big ego of competition will shatter the Republican Party, just like it did to the Democrats when they after Obamacare was done. Now, Barack Obama was reelected, but they didn't get the majority back. They didn't get the seats in the House and the Senate that they needed, even when they thought they would, because their egos had that moment to fight against each other instead of the common enemy. So if Trump doesn't recognize that there needs to be a different relationship with your allies, whether that's foreign or domestic, then he's going to dig himself a pit where he's going to be a lame duck president, a very, very loud lame duck president. And he's got the potential right now to actually get some good reform done if he doesn't put himself in that hole.
Well, I know he's braggadocious and all of that. And, you know, as a businessman, you can make decisions a lot quicker. Congress moves at glacial speed and egos and all the things you're talking about. It just, I don't know, you know, back to the stock market, you know, there was the so-called Trump bump, and then we've had, you know, some ups and downs, especially in the last week or so, down 100, down 100, and then boom, we hit, what, 180 yesterday. So you guys think that the ups and – I know ups and downs have happened forever, but you think the big swings are still going to happen for another couple of months or
– Oh, what Jake said earlier, we're going to see as long as President Trump continues to behave the way he's behaving, which is to do something and then roll it back. For example, I don't know. Let me give you an example that doesn't have to do with the economy, but it's still very, very real. Kellyanne
Conway
announced in a national interview that the press had not covered a terrorist massacre in Bowling Green, Kentucky. But that's because there never was a massacre in Bowling Green, Kentucky. As long as you get statements that are coming out of the White House that are not coordinated and thought out and vetted through the rest of the administration and not carefully put out, we're going to get volatility because of the uncertainty of what follows next. If things are well thought out and they represent a strategy, then Wall Street will get in a position, oh, obviously this is well thought out and this is the direction they're going, and they'll figure the effect. The analysts and the traders will figure the effect it has on earnings, and the stock market will either go up or down. If you get a bunch of random statements, any one of which can blow the whole thing up or send us through the stratosphere, guess what? The market is going to act like things are about to blow up or about to go through the stratosphere. So you're going to get a lot of volatility.
There's another thing here. And during the election season, when one candidate stayed well ahead of another, we had some gradual movement upward in the market. It was relatively flat. It was still a holding pattern, but there was some degree, okay, this person's way ahead, so we should have some stability in the market.
We at least forecast based on this person's
right
plans.
And this goes all the way back through the original primaries. So this isn't just the Trump-Clinton match. This goes all the way back. When you have someone ahead, and as a business person, you can start making some reasonable decisions based on their expected policies, then you get more stability. When the race gets neck and neck, you get volatility. It isn't because the market is made up of the same people that do the voting, like tremendously one person more than the other. They like certainty. They like to know what they're doing. So once the election was over, and this is something I said during the election, once the election's over, I expect to see a move up in the market, because there's been this holding pattern, this waiting. So Trump or Clinton would have gotten that. There are a lot of actions going, and because those actions, some certainty comes in and we get this big, these big boosts, but there's enough uncertainty in every direction right now that it's hard for people to make decisions. And we're about out of time. So we didn't get a chance to really fully answer that. But
No, you did. Can I call back? I got another question.
Sure. Call back. Yeah, absolutely. Call back next hour. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. Do you notice how we able to kick right into that Jeff and Jake thing, like we know what we're talking about?
Yeah, like we actually know who we are. It's crazy.
If you'd like to contact us off the air, we also are the principal advisors in an investment advisory firm that caters to people of a higher invested net worth. And the telephone number there locally would be 254. Now, this is a hard one to remember. It's 254, which is our area code, 947-1111. That's 254-947-1111. Or
you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to podcasts in case you didn't get enough of our voices. You can get more of it. And you can read our newsletters. You can email us directly. We use those for the program, jake@tpwc.com or jeff@tpwc.com. And until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.